No sooner had the assassins completed their bloody work than they themselves were promoting a quite different tale. The man they had slain, they claimed, was not Bardia, the son of Cyrus, at all. Cambyses, jealous and savage, had ordered his execution years before. Bardia's doppelganger, the conspirators hurriedly announced, had been a Magus, Gaumata by name. An obscure and low-born villain he may have been, and yet so potent had his sorcery proved itself, and so audacious his plot, that he had almost won the empire by his fraud. The conspirators were in no mood to tolerate dissent. The warning given by Darius could not have been more stentorian. "Thou who shalt be king hereafter, protect thyself vigorously from the lie. The man who shall be a follower of the lie, him do thou punish well." Here, from Darius, the master political strategist, was a dazzling sleight of hand. It would serve to place not the assassins, but their accusers on the defensive. Skeptics were to be anathematized as the enemies of truth. And this, for any Persian, was a feared and dreadful fate. It was an article of faith to Darius's countrymen that they were the most honest people in the world. Three things were taught them, it was said: to ride, to fire a bow, and to tell the truth. Darius, by threatening those who might doubt his story of the Magus's crimes, was not just shoring up a rickety case. His claims were altogether more soaring. Only a Persian could have made them, for only a Persian could understand what truth really meant. He knew, as more benighted peoples did not, that the universe without truth would be undone and lost to perpetual night. More than an abstraction, more even than an ideal, it formed instead the very fabric of existence. This was why, in the beginning, when Ahura Mazda, greatest of the gods, had summoned time and creation into being, he had engendered Arta, who was truth, to give order to the universe. Without Arta, it would have lacked form or beauty, and the great cycles of existence set in motion by Lord Mazda could not have brought life into the world. Even so, the work of truth was never done. Just as fire, when it rises to the heavens, is accompanied by black smoke, so Arta, the Persians knew, was shadowed by Drauga, the lie. Two orders, one of perfection, the other of falsehood, each the image of the other, were coiled in a conflict as ancient as time. What should mortals do, then, but take the side of Arta against Drauga, truth against the lie, lest the universe itself should totter and fail? "The wretch who weaves deceit will bring death into his country," so it had been anciently proclaimed. How much more deadly the peril, then, if a wretch had somehow seized his country's throne? The Magus, by taking on the image of Bardia and impersonating the rightful king, had handed to Drauga the sceptre of the world. Darius and his fellows, by riding to Sikyavautish, had toppled an evil infinitely more threatening than a mere impostor. Far from staging a squalid putsch, they had been engaged in nothing less than the redemption of the cosmos. And now, with Gaumata justly toppled and dispatched, the throne which he had tainted stood empty. The insignia of royal power, a robe, a bow and a shield, waited in Sikyavautish for the rightful claimant. As Darius would never cease to acknowledge, everything he was, everything he had achieved, was due to the favour of Ahura Mazda. "He bore me aid, the other gods too, because I was not faithless, I was not a follower of the lie, I was not false in my actions." Darius was surely protesting too much. But as a regicide and usurper, he had little choice. With his claim to the throne so tenuous, he could hardly rely on it to justify his coup. Other legitimization had to be concocted, and fast. Darius might not have been the son of Cyrus, but he could pose as something infinitely more impressive, the proxy of the good lord Ahura Mazda himself. This seamless identification of his own power with that of a universal god was a development full of moment for the future. Usurpers had been claiming divine sanction for their actions since time immemorial, but never such as Ahura Mazda could provide. Already, with the daring and creativity that were the trademarks of his style, Darius was moving with deadly speed to take advantage of this fact. Out of murder and usurpation, he would manufacture a rare legitimacy for himself. Out of weakness, he would forge a strength such as no monarch had ever possessed before. Dizzying as this startling ambition was, however, so too was the yawning of a waiting abyss. The chosen one of Ahura Mazda could not afford to stumble. Just one slip, and Darius would have failed. Already, as he and the other conspirators nursed their strength in media, disturbing news was coming through to them of the Empire's reaction to their coup. In Elam, an ancient kingdom on the borders of Persia, open revolt had broken out. In Babylon, the great metropolis, which was the largest and wealthiest city in the world, a pretender was reported to have emerged to claim its long-vacant throne. For Darius, the self-proclaimed champion of light, the ultimate test was looming. Not only his own future, but that of the whole Near East was at stake. Ahead of him waited the road to Babylon.